Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from PDX Pendable Stage and Studio Supplies. PDX Pendable sells and rents to film and theater productions, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Airy LED lighting. More information available at 503-887-5880. And at pdxpendables.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy Whoa looks a scream. Animal, now whoa. Andy Whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
This is Art Focus, the show where we talk to artists and curators about visual art. And it's coming to you on your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. My name's Joseph Gallivan, and before I get started, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We've had to cancel our usual spring membership drive because of the station shutdown, which is a precaution against the new coronavirus. So we hope you'll show your support by giving online instead. We know times are tough, so if you're not able to donate, don't worry. But if you can, please show your support for this free community resource. KBOO.fm. Okay, moving on to today's show. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Theo Downs Le Guin. He's the owner of Up 4 Gallery, and we're here looking at Frequencies of Opacity, a show by Danielle Roney, which is up now through May 15th, 2020, by appointment only. Thanks for doing Art Focus, Theo.
Thanks, Joseph. I'm really happy to have an opportunity to talk about this exhibition, which we opened at the beginning of March. And I hope some listeners had a chance to see the works very shortly thereafter. We closed the gallery to the public and are now open online and by appointment only, like most of our fellow galleries in town and throughout the world. Danielle is a Brooklyn-based artist, and this is her first exhibition with us. She has been working for decades on projects that involve human movement and migration and emigration patterns. And we have three bodies of work in the exhibition here, Strata, Whispers, and Publix, each of which speaks in different ways to projects that Danielle's been working on recently around undocumented immigrant experiences in the U.S. And the first works I'd like to talk about are Strata 0 and 01. If I can describe these for you, they're two large floor-standing and ceiling-hung sculptural works that involve thin, perforated metal tubes in which there are LED lights. The works are attached to two controllers mounted in the ceiling. And those controllers are using data based on immigrant stories verbal stories that were recorded with immigrant collaborators that Daniel has built relationships with over years. Those controllers translate the stories into light displays that are played in the tubes. And so what we're seeing is a form of communication, actually very personal stories of immigrant experience, but for us as the viewer, those stories are essentially anonymous and private because they're shown to us as data visualization, as light, rather than as verbal storytelling. For Danielle and for her collaborators, these sculptures are a form of communication, but they're also a form of retaining privacy for a population who often doesn't have that privacy, and for resisting traditional modes of storytelling and of sharing in unequal power relationships.
They're amazing works. It's this perforated steel tube. It looks like a sort of honeycomb pattern, or I guess they're little circles. And inside are these strips of LEDs like you can find anywhere now, but they're stuck to one side of the inside of the tube. And then the lights are coming and going in slow-moving patterns that are hard to predict. So sometimes a tube will be completely lit up. Sometimes a light will fade out at one end and gradually go out completely. And the other thing is that these two works both use curves in really interesting ways. These curves that sort of push against each other and resist each other. Both of them are touching the floor, but their sort of other element is up in the air, suspended. There's something very dynamic about them. I could see these as being public art somewhere, if they could be protected from people tripping over them. And the colors are basically very sort of light, bluish white lights and silver steel. Is there any variation on the coloring of the light?
The lights can change within an almost infinite band of colors. The way Danielle has set them up, it's a fairly constrained band that's mostly kind of whites and pale purples, pale greens, pale violets, and blues. So the work is very elegant, very restrained. It's kind of visually seductive, and indeed, if you look at Danielle's work in public places over a long period of time, you'll see that she is really good at making these works that, if you know nothing about the artist, about her interests and her project, are visually stunning and arresting. But as you learn more about what is actually behind the work, what's driving this pattern of light display in this case, and that those come from specific people's stories, you begin to see that these are not just aesthetically pleasing works, but they're also acts of an odd kind of storytelling, a storytelling where the person telling the story is not making it completely revealed or obvious to us, but at the same time, even the way the lights move within the sculpture does imply that there's something going on here that isn't purely random. And I really love that aspect of her work, that it can be seen at two levels, and that if you see a large-scale installation of hers, you know, kind of in passing in a public place, you may only view it as an aesthetic experience, but once you start to dig in, you realize it is far more than just a retinal experience.
So just tell us about the stories that have been translated into light here. The stories of immigrants to the U.S., is that right? And then in what context are these people speaking? Are they speaking to Danielle? How does she take the audio and transform it into light?
So some of these projects draw on more than one collaborator or population that she's worked with. She has worked with immigrant populations in many different parts of the country, and she has solicited stories in ways that protect privacy and anonymity. In most cases, the populations she's working with are undocumented, so there are real concerns about her ability to not put her collaborators in jeopardy. And so, for example, one of the techniques she uses is to create a secure and private web portal where people can voluntarily tell their story if they wish, but there's no personal or identifying data attached to that story. And Danielle does not make the story per se available in a public way, because even without identifying information, that story could be compromising to someone's safety. So that is part of the practical reason that she is telling these stories in a way that is visual and metaphorical rather than literal.
Let's move over to the second of the three groups of work. These three are very different. They're three 3D printed. They look like meshes, white, sort of twisted parabolas. They could be doves, you know, or they could be butterflies, but they're so complex. You look at them from every angle, and they look like, you know, they're 3D graphs, basically, and they're on little black plinths. Tell us again about how Danielle sourced the data to make these shapes.
So these are visual representations of data based on voiceovers from cinematic projects that Danielle has done. So she works in a variety of different mediums, and film has been one of those over many years. So in this case, the stories that are being represented in the sculptures are also available to us through her film projects. And you had asked me a few minutes ago whether these whispers, as the sculptures are called, are literally based on whispered voiceovers. And I don't know the answer to that question, but I guess I have assumed that she used whisper more as a symbolic statement of the inability of immigrants to have a strong voice in society. So often what we get is at most a whisper from them. Whether the actual voiceovers were whispers, I don't know. But the question that she posed herself in thinking about how to render the voice data in a sculptural form was, what would it feel and look like to be able to hold a whisper in the palm of your hand? And one of the privileges of working in the gallery is we do get to hold sculptures in the palms of our hands. And these sculptures are, although they look extremely delicate and extremely brittle, they're actually a flexible polymer 3D print. They're incredibly lightweight. They do weigh about what I think a whisper would weigh. But they have a real strength and resiliency as well. And as you said, Joseph, they kind of look like a mesh or a net. And they have this quality when you hold them of almost like you could scrunch them up and they would still bounce back to their original form.
Yeah, that's very different from the first pieces, strata, the two big steel pieces. These are, you know, like you said, you could pick them up and put them somewhere in your home. You price them at $3,500, and I always wonder, you know, when something is easy to replicate, you know, you just hit print again, does that change the way you price things? Because the steelworks looked like there would be a lot of work to make another copy, but things like this, you know, what do you and the artist talk about when you're trying to figure out editions and that kind of thing? Particularly, I think with 3D printing, because it's so easy, once you've got the final image you want, then you can just like let it run. So tell me what kind of conversation do you have with Danielle about that?
Well, I guess I would take a little issue with the notion of easy, or I would say if you look at the entire process of conceiving and making a work of art, where does ease and lack of ease come in? So, you know, in any work of art, regardless of the medium, where the value, for lack of a better word, is found is in the ideas as much as in the making. And so if you think about the whole process that led up to conceptualizing the idea of representing speech as a three-dimensional form and then making that meaningful in terms of whose speech she's representing, taking populations whose voice is usually not heard in any form, let alone in the valorized environment of an art gallery, all of that thinking, all of that research, building the relationships with the immigrant collaborators, leading up to the point of then actually fabricating these sculptures, you know, that to me is what signifies value in the artwork. I think it's also the case with 3D printed work of all kinds that people often underestimate how difficult it is to actually make a really good work, even if you could, in theory, press the print button over and over again. Again, it's the labor and the thought that leads up to the moment that you do press print. The other issue, in much more kind of nuts and bolts terms, is the work unique or additioned? So has the artist decided that for various reasons she might want to make more than one of it? And in that case, how big is the addition? And in that sense, 3D printed objects fall very much within the traditional pricing guidelines for any kind of additioned work, like prints or photographs, or for that matter, sculptures, cast sculptures. And so, you know, we are thinking about the entirety of the artistic proposition, how many the artist wants to make, why she wants to make more than one if she does, and in this case, these are unique objects. And then, you know, what the costs of fabrication are, because although 3D printing is often comparatively inexpensive as contrasted with, say, bronze, it is often more expensive than people think it is, just in sheer materials cost and access to the technology as well.
Yeah, so these materials are the kind of what I would think of as early stage 3D printing. It's that white polymer that's kind of matte in finish, in texture. As that technology develops, you know, you can print with metal now, and it's just taking off like crazy. Do you think, have you talked to Danielle Roney about the use of 3D printing? Because she's obviously skilled in other kinds of production. Do you talk about 3D printing with her?
Not a lot. I mean, I have to admit, I am no expert in 3D printing. For me, it is kind of a means to an end. And while Danielle is an extremely technically adept, technically savvy artist and does a lot of large-scale commissions that involve knowledge around everything from metal fabrication to software engineering, I think for her, the 3D printing is the means, not the end. She does some 3D printed work, but it's not a focus of her practice. Mm-hmm. It happens to be a really, I guess, convenient, for lack of a better word, way to work in data visualization. And at the core of a lot of her work is that notion of taking data, which is a very bloodless term. For her, data is usually human experience and specific people's stories, and turning that into something that is tangible and physical.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Theo Downs Le Guin. We're in his art gallery called Up 4 Gallery in the Pearl District, and he's talking about Danielle Roney's show Frequencies of Opacity, and this show is up through May 15th, 2020, by appointment only. So, Theo, the third big piece in here is my favorite, because we're on camera right now. We're being watched by five cameras. Actually, they're kind of pointing out in a semicircle, but we must be on at least three of them. And so you've got five Nest cameras. I think they're the doorbell cameras, right, that you have for tracking who's at your door?
Yeah, that Google product line.
Yeah, yeah, these black circular cameras. And then each one is on a kind of black armature, which is held up by another armature, which is a steel, like a microphone stand. It's made by impact, and this is all heavy steel, like the bases of these three-legged sturdy sort of stool legs at different heights, and the steel tubing is very thick, and they, you know, even the handles for turning, for clamping everything, are big and strong. And then you just have these little plastic cameras at the end. It's actually kind of in your face, you know, it's sticking out, and you kind of, when you, once you realize that cameras, you're thinking, oh, everywhere I go, this thing is looking at me, whereas normally, you know, I'm the art consumer, I'm looking at it. So tell us, what was Danielle thinking when she made this piece? And then we'll talk about where the video shows up in the world.
So this is a fascinating piece, and it connects, superficially at least, to a lot of different work about surveillance by contemporary artists. As you said, the work is called Publix. There are five Nest cameras, which were very specifically chosen not only because they are a commonly available, lower-priced live stream camera that can be connected to any network, but also because they are aesthetically a rather sinister-looking camera. I mean, if you imagine what a small-scale, consumer-friendly surveillance device looks like, to me, this is exactly what it looks like. It's black, and it looks a little bit like HAL 2000 from A Space Odyssey. These cameras are connected to a private network, and that network is available to view by only one person. That person is not the artist, as you might expect. The person is an anonymous to us immigrant collaborator who's been working with the artist for some time. And this project has been replicated in several different other spaces. And in every case, the tables are turned. We, as the viewers, are actually being surveilled. And the person who is able to surveil us is a person who typically, in our culture and society and in our political moment, would be the subject of surveillance rather than the person who has the power to see and surveil others. So, to some degree, Danielle is turning surveillance culture, particularly with regard to immigrants, on its ear. But I think in the gallery setting, she is also playing very intelligently with traditions of power structures within the art world. So we are the viewers of these objects here in the gallery, but we're also the viewed, and really we are primarily the viewed because, as you described, what we're looking at is essentially an aggregation of commercially available products, C-stands, and cameras that are put together in a kind of cold and very industrial-looking display. It looks like a lot of contemporary art does, and it's not unpretty in its way, but it's also quite threatening. So even though we're viewing it, there is a sense that we're not in our traditional comfortable role as the holders of power over the artist and over the object that we're viewing. And I love the way Danielle has completely subverted that notion of what it means to be viewer versus viewed, but also the fact that she's taken herself out of the equation as artist. So she's not just turning the power structure around by recapturing it herself, but she is then in turn taking that power and putting it into the hands of an anonymous other who is neither the object or the subject of the artwork.
So this person is an immigrant, and they're somewhere, where, in America, watching the screen?
In the Midwest.
In the Midwest, okay. Is there any kind of end game? Does this person have to report back what they see? Do they have an obligation to clock in a few hours a week watching the screen? I mean, most of the time, right, it's an empty gallery. Has been for the last month. So what's the very end part of the process of this work?
I think the end part of the process is no obligation, no expectation whatsoever. That person has complete agency and power to view or not view the stream at any moment. And putting any rules around that would, in a way, contradict the subversion of power structures that Danielle is trying to create here. But there is a real poignancy that I think you're alluding to this work in this moment, where after First Thursday opening more than a month ago now, the collaborator has had nothing to view but an empty gallery. And in an odd way, this exhibition in total works very well for this moment because there's a lot of stillness and quietness in Danielle's work, literally quietness, because she relies much more on light than she does on sound in most of her work. but also because the gallery is empty. And so the collaborator is only able to see maybe a few passing people here in the Pearl District outside the window, because the cameras are partially pointed toward the window, to see the other artworks that are on display and the occasional gallery staff person who's in and out to take care of some urgent business. And, I think in a way this is the right exhibition for this moment because of the way in which it explores the notion of private versus public and how stories can be told not just in their literal, verbal, traditional forms, but in poetic and very quiet forms as well. But I must admit, I am also deeply disappointed that more people haven't been able to see the exhibition in person to think about these things that are difficult to think about if you're only viewing online, and to give the work and the artists their due.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about this time, which is, you know, mid-April. We're still under a stay-home order, and you can walk around the streets. You're encouraged to wear a mask. You can still kind of move around, but most people are limiting themselves to staying home, and the people are agitating a bit in the media to go back outside. This show features the voices of immigrants and undocumented immigrants, and they have been totally knocked off the news cycle for the last month. Really, all we've had is politics and coronavirus, and all the traditional stories like the wall, and I guess unemployment's back is a big story, but these people have been marginalized again from the media because of their biggest stories out there. What do you think could eventually come of this kind of artwork? Could the video that the person sees ever be saved and like reproduced and sort of fed back into the system, or is this, you know, this endless surveillance with no result? Is that the metaphor she's going for?
I think that's probably up to the collaborator and Danielle working together, and I don't know whether there's a second or additional lives for this project in terms of how that might be used. I don't actually think the surveillance footage is being captured. It's a live stream. But there is a recursive quality to a lot of Danielle's projects in which material...
A what quality?
A recursive quality where material from prior projects shows up in future projects. So I wouldn't rule anything out. I think, though, there's kind of another purpose being served here of maybe an opportunity for us to experience some empathy with the immigrants that she's been collaborating with, in the sense that, you know, most of us are at home now, feeling varying degrees of anything from trapped to relief or some combination of that. And one of the interesting things about how undocumented immigrant populations are often treated in the U.S. is that although their arrival and their experience is defined by geographic distance and disparity, they came from a long way to be here, their physical mobility is often highly constrained for reasons of safety and trying to stay invisible and below the radar of law enforcement here. And to some degree, we're all having that experience now for different reasons, to be sure, and I'm not trying to create a sense of false equivalency here. But it is really useful, I think, for all of us to get a sense of what it is like to have our mobility to some degree involuntarily constrained, and to think about how that experience for those of us who haven't been through that before might relate to and increase empathy for people who have no choice but to live that experience every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are great degrees of difference there, you know, because if you're undocumented and you hear ISA in the neighborhood, you're going to be like hiding behind the couch, whereas you and I, you know, we might get a bit of side eye if we don't wear a mask down through the Pearl. So they're different things. But I wanted to ask you about, you were in New York recently, right, which is a hot spot, and you came back and quarantined yourself for 2 weeks. Just tell us, what was it like, the difference between Portland and New York in your visit?
Well, it was the first week of March that I was there. We were exhibiting work at the Armory Show. Julie Green, a Corvallis-based artist we worked with for many years. And I had a sense that things were going south before I left Portland. The way I remember that is partly because a couple of days before I left, I placed a big online order of shelf-stable foods. So clearly somewhere in the back of my mind, I was planning for, if not the worst, a not very good situation on return. And I remember when I was sitting at the airport waiting to board my flight, I ordered a whole bunch of frozen food and had it sent to my dad's house because I suddenly got very worried that he was not going to have enough to eat while I was gone.
Where is he?
He lives here in Portland as well. And so I got to New York and things were unbelievably normal there. Leaving Portland, I had already seen people wearing masks at the airport. Things were starting to feel very different. And in New York, things did not feel different at all, which in retrospect now seems crazy because, you know, New York's path has accelerated much faster than ours and has been much more horrifying than most people's path in Portland. Over the course of the week that I was there, I spent almost the entire week on Pier 92 and 94, enormous piers out over the West Side Highway where the art fair is held. That is the largest art fair in New York and one of the largest in the world. It attracts 50 to 60,000 people a year. And in terms of attendance, they did very well this year. The general